You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, May 26th, 2021, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santa Maria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, folks.
Welcome back, Kara. Hope you're feeling better. You were a little under the weather last week.
All good. Yay, modern medicine.
Yeah. Yay. Right, I often think about that, because but when your kids get sick or whatever, and you think, gee, 100 years ago, we'd be dead. You know?
Yeah,
seriously,
Yep.
I probably would have died 3 times in my life if I was sans modern medicine, you know what I mean?
Oh, and you think about just modern technology, right? I can't see crap without my glasses. I would have gotten eaten a long time ago. Right, Jay? You and I would be lunch meat.
But glasses have been around for a long time.
Kara, if I wasn't already dead, which I would have been, I would be an emotional basket case.
Well, without your glasses.
But how long?
No, I'm talking about...
Talking centuries.
Yeah.
Glasses.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, we've had medicine for centuries, just not really, really, really good stuff.
Yeah, but I mean, that's most of humanity did not have glasses.
True, exactly. Most of humanity did not have glasses.
Well, a lot of humanity didn't read.
That's not why I need mine.
Oh, you have
I just realized I need mine to drive a car, which is also not relevant.
Yeah, well, driving those cars in the 17th century was really tough.
Glasses have been around since the 13th century.
Yeah, but some medicine has been around.
They weren't great.
Yeah, and we had crappy medicine back then too.
150,000 years without glasses.
Yeah,
humans.
So for a very long time, there were people walking around that couldn't see shit,
and they bumped into all sorts of stuff.
Yeah, but they died when they were 30. You know.
Yeah, exactly. It's fine.
So we're gonna go on to our news items, because we have a great interview coming up with Mick West later in the show. We want to leave enough time for that. So we're going to get right into the news items, starting with Kara, who's going to tell us more information about how science is broken.
Oh boy.
I love this, you guys. I pitch stories to Steve every week. I give him options, from my feed reader. And his response was, I can't resist the replication crisis. I just can't resist. Something new. We've got to talk about it. Okay. So this is a really interesting study that was published in Science Advances called Non-Replicable Publications Are Cited More Than Replicable Ones. And really, the title tells you the crux of what we're going to be talking about today, that they did an investigation where they looked at replicable or not versus non-replicable studies, and they realized that studies that could not be replicated tended to be cited more often.
Hmm.
This is bad. So, okay, let's look a little bit. Let's dig a little bit deeper.
Oh my
they
God.
Looked at these three publications, evaluating replicability of laboratory experiments in economics, evaluating replicability of social science experiments published in Nature and Science between 2010 and 2015, and estimating the reproducibility of psychological science. So basically, they took these three big flagship articles in which individuals looked at reproducibility or replicability within psychological science, within economics, and then within what we might think of as more wet science or general science, but specifically in Nature and Science, which are the two kind of most premier peer-reviewed journals. The N of the psychology paper is much higher. I think it looks at specifically 100 source papers. The N of the Science and Nature and the econ studies is lower. In Science and Nature, they looked at 21 studies, and in the econ field, they looked at 18 studies. And then they looked at a bunch of papers that cite these studies. They analyzed them all. So they're like, okay, this is 139 papers. Now we're going to look at 20,252 papers that cite these different papers, and we're going to see if we can't come up with some takeaways here. They realize that, here's something kind of scary. Studies that failed to replicate from the time they were published onward were cited 153 times more often than studies that had been able to be replicated.
Whoa.
Lee.
Huh. Not good.
And they found that this was even more pronounced in studies published in Science and Nature.
Yeah, 300 times more.
Yeah.
In those journals. Yeah, that's huge.
So huge. And Another really important takeaway of this, I mean, there's a lot of cool takeaways that we can dive into, but another one is that the researchers actually cited a body of literature that exists that shows that individual peer reviewers, experts, are very good at assessing whether or not they think a study is replicable based on its methodology, based on the claims that are made, based on the body of literature that they've been reading because they're experts within their field. Like, very often they can predict the replicability of studies. And so they ask this very important question: why are non-replicable papers being accepted for publication in the first place? Mm-hmm. If when somebody has a wild and crazy finding, and then they go before a peer-reviewed journal and say, please publish my finding. Yes, we don't know yet if it is replicable because it has not yet been published. So people don't know yet. They haven't tried. But experts within this field tend to have a good idea. They tend to be able to say, this doesn't seem likely that you'll be able to replicate this. Why aren't they saying, let's wait until we have corroborating evidence before this is published? Why are they saying, okay, let's get it on the books? And then after the fact, sadly, what we're seeing is that those studies get cited more often.
But Kara, that's also the answer, because getting cited is what increases your impact factor. And the impact factor is what increases your advertising revenue in the traditional journals. And so printing these provocative papers that can't be replicated are good for business.
And this is what the study authors that I'm specifically citing here, this study, that's what they say. Perhaps this is the source, not the outcome. Mm-hmm. of the reproduction crisis or the replication crisis. And then it becomes this runaway feedback loop because the culture of science is that you have to publish and you have to publish often. That's how you get tenure.
Yeah. And not only that, you want to publish something new and provocative. Mm-hmm. And those are the ones that are just by chance alone, less likely to be true. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're replicating a finding that's already published.
Those are the least impactful.
Least impactful,
speaking.
But they're all probably the most useful. And this is also—it's not just replicable studies, but there's a general citation bias, right? It's not only a publication bias, but there's a citation bias, and that favors positive results, that favors novel results, et cetera.
Well, and this is why what we're seeing is not only the issue that studies that will not become replicated tend to be cited more often, but studies that are replications of previous studies are cited much less often.
Yeah.
So you've got this dual-pronged problem. Studies that in and of themselves are likely not replicable are reverberating through the scientific community much more loudly and the public at large, right? Because these are the ones that get picked up by the press.
Yeah.
And then on top of that, you don't have a lot of incentive as a scientist to publish replications of previous literature. And replications do happen. It's great. That's how they were able to do this experiment, is they were able to look at places where things had been replicated. But they found that A, those weren't cited very often. B, sadly, it's unlikely that in later citations, even ones after the replications or the lack of replication had been published, it's very unlikely that later citations actually specify that the study that they're citing couldn't be replicated.
Mm-hmm.
So then you have this reconstitution, this recodification of a study that's no longer even that weighty, but within the community at large, it feels weighty because people aren't doing the due diligence to say, oh, this hallmark study that I want to cite in my paper, did anybody try to do this again? Oh, crap, they did and they couldn't figure it out, or they didn't get the same result. I should probably write about that.
Mm-hmm.
That's not happening.
Yeah, there needs to be a shift in the culture. And this is not like a new problem. People are aware of this. There are proposed fixes, like big journals requiring scientists to do internal replications before they publish their data. That would be a good idea. So the replications are kind of built in, and to prioritizing replications more in their publication model. As a journal, you mean? Yeah, as a journal.
Yeah.
And academic institutions need to reward that academically.
For sure. There needs to be a culture change. And another thing that the authors recommended was perhaps literally putting the editor's names on these papers.
Mm-hmm. Because that sounds like a great idea. I mean,
yeah, there's a certain amount of accountability they have.
Of course.
Yeah, so the incentive structure is a little out of whack. You know,
again, it's a lot out of whack.
Eventually it all sorts itself out, but it's a lot of wasted time and energy. And in medicine, of course, it's like people are actually making practice decisions based upon preliminary studies that eventually will get retracted or not replicated or whatever.
And like you said, in medicine, lives are at stake. You know, we're talking public health, policy, medicine, psychology, even economics. Whole economic systems could be hinging on this. You know, big decisions that affect people's lives are often hinged on single studies. And that's something that we really, really need to take seriously.
Yeah, it definitely needs to be fixed. Mm. All right, thanks, Kara. Jay, what is the maximum human lifespan, and how do we know?
4'1".
Steve, a new study finds that people could live up to 150 years without any major intervention. But of course, you know, there's a ton of stuff I have to tell you in order for this to really make sense. So why is it that some people can drink and smoke and live, you know, well past 100 years old when other people, you know, get lung cancer in their 40s? This is it's a pretty obvious answer to the question, but it is a valid question. And the real question is, what is the maximum lifespan for the average human being? Well, to answer the first question, it's genetics. And the answer to the second question, genetics is a part of it. Right. So what's the maximum lifespan that a human being could live? Well, of course, you have to have good genes to live an extended life. But there's lots of other factors that come into play. So let's remove all the big things that end up killing most people. So first, let's say that you have excellent genetics. Like I said, let's remove heart disease and cancer, dying from an accident. And, you know, we have to remove stress because stress is, you know, probably one of the worst things that we all have to deal with. Good luck. So researchers know that even removing these factors, the human body still loses its ability to keep its multitude of biological systems functioning correctly. And in the end, we will eventually succumb to, you know, the degradation of the body's basic functioning, right? We're going to die because our body is slowly going to become more and more incapable of restoring itself. So on May 25th, 2021, in Nature Communications, researchers published their results to try to answer this question, and they concluded that humans can live between 120 and 150 years.
Well, don't we already have some people who have lived to be 120?
Yeah, no? 122 was the top number.
Okay, well, then really didn't take a study to know that.
No, the study, yeah, but the study did something else. They didn't just say, hey, let's look at some data and, you know, and we'll throw out some numbers. Like, they actually came up with something new. So Timothy Perkov, a researcher at Singapore-based company called Giro, that's G-E-R-O, and his colleagues were analyzing the quote-unquote pace of aging. And this pace of aging ultimately sets the limit of a human being's lifespan. The researchers analyzed groups of people from the United States, the UK, and Russia. Their research included studying the blood cell counts and the daily amount of steps that people would take. Right? Two things that seemingly don't have anything to do with each other. And they were doing this to measure, in essence, they want to know how much people were moving, and steps was the easiest way to average that out. So with both blood count and number of steps taken, there was a similar pattern that they found. As the subject's age increased, non-disease factors caused this predictable and incremental decrease in an individual's ability to regain blood cells and the number of total steps after some type of biological disruption, right? So I'm not talking about, you know, having some type of kidney failure or whatever. We're just talking about other things that would happen to people as they age. The researchers established a predictable pace of decline, right? So they're calling it a pace of decline, and used this to determine when somebody's biological resilience would completely disappear. Right. So they're using that steady pace of decline to basically map out, well, how far in the future could this person live before they just cease to function, before some major catastrophe happens that they can't recover
from. And that's
the
150.
Right. So this, of course, leads to that person's death. Right. So when their body can no longer repair the damage that was happening, they basically got diminished to such a point where there was nothing to regain. They were done. Their body could not continue to do the processes to continue to increase blood count or get the number of steps back that you used to be able to take. They determined that between 120 and 150 years that the human body would just lose its ability to come back to health.
I would think, Jay, that it's a lot closer to 120 because if it really were 150, I would think we'd have some evidence of some people entering the 130s, at least the 130s. Right, we'd have
someone
some.
Somewhere.
But don't forget.
Had just like epic genes.
What did I remove from the list, which is not being removed from our reality?
Cancer.
I removed cancer. Mm. We removed stress.
Because basically you removed a lot of things that, yes, have a genetic component, but like you removed all the environmental consequences. And the truth is we live on planet Earth, which is like irradiated and has pollution. And like we have carcinogens and we have environmental pressures on us that this modeling pretends don't exist.
Well, I think they did it to just establish a baseline. Like, you know, if they're taking a person in an environment that's predictable, right? Because if you add in too many factors, then what are you measuring? You know, like they wanted to know how long could the human body go for under ideal circumstances, one of which you have absolutely no control over, which is, you know, your genetics. You might have some control over the amount of stress. You know, you could take better care of your cardiovascular system, blah, blah, blah. But still, like, you know, they are creating this bubble of a study that isn't an ideal situation. But I think to get to the point where they're saying, look, you know, as we mitigate more and more health, you know, diseases and health concerns, which we are, you know, if you look at just cancer research alone, we've come such an amazingly long way in the last 100 years. It's profound. I mean, children that have cancer, you know, the cure rate for childhood cancer is in the upper 90 percentile. It's incredibly high. You know, maybe 50 years, 100 years from now, we might have mitigated, you know, a lot of this stuff that's what we would consider today to be extreme causes of death, but they might also be low hanging fruit. You know, maybe they could get rid of cardiovascular disease in the future. You know, I'd hope that we do. So they also found that as subjects grew older, their body's ability to get back to a normal, stable level decreased, right? I've already described that, but I'm kind of retreading this ground to make a further point. So this means that they need more time to recover from some type of biological disruption. None of this is surprising, right? Because, you know, I'm in my 50s and I know that I don't heal as fast as I used to. You know, you get surgery, it takes longer to recover than a 20-year-old. We know that it takes older people longer to, in general, recover from pretty much anything than a younger person. An illness can also make an older person's body overreact in some cases, and that could be deadly, like take an increase in blood pressure, for example. You know, your body's overreacting and increasing your blood pressure wildly from something that a younger person's body just simply wouldn't react that way, which is, again, another sign that, you know, the aging process is disrupting systems inside your body. So it's important to note here that researchers aren't saying that it's impossible for humans to one day develop any interventions that could make people live longer, right? This study is not saying, and that's it, 150, and that's it, you're done. They're saying that without doing a significant mitigation, the human body as it is today, that's about how long it can go.
Yeah, so without like doing things that quote unquote reverse aging.
Right,
or
like CRISPR.
Aging.
Right.
Yeah.
Some type of CRISPR level, you know, change to the way your body functions, you know, that they say 120 to 150. Now, I agree, and the first thing I thought of is what you guys were saying initially about 5 minutes ago. You know, how come we're not seeing people into their 130s and 140s and 150s? And the answer is Kara. Kara said it. It's our environment.
We live on Earth.
Yeah, that is the thing that you know, we don't live in a stress-free environment. We live in a stress-dense environment. But they had to, like I said, create a baseline. And I find this interesting, and I also found this very interesting, this next thing.
I mean, I read another article that's kind of related to this. They were talking about a study of people who have reached over like 105 or so, and they examine their, you know, their genomes, and they, one thing that they found in common is like it came down to a handful of genes that they had that were similar, that were involved in genetic repair, basically repairing the DNA. And that made perfect sense to me, because I know that, you know, some animals live longer, right? Like there's a turtle that's like 200. There's a shark that lives to be centuries old. Why do they get to live so long? How can they live that long? And a key part of that, from what I could tell, is the ability to do genetic repairs, because just having a metabolism is what's aging you. By because you're breathing and alive, it's causing this genetic detritus to build up and duplication errors, you know, when replicating the DNA to creep in. And the better that you're able to clean that up, the fitter you are, the longer you'll last. And they identified, you know, the five genes. And to me, I was like, that's pretty fascinating because, I mean, can't they just then now, use CRISPR at some point to make sure that those critical genes are up to snuff so that your genetic repair mechanisms are as good as they could be, or even potentially in the future, the farther future, augmented beyond, you know, what they could potentially be for any human, so that your genetic repair is so good that you can be 110 and actually act like you're 70 or 60.
But that's so much linked to age of reproduction. And that's something that I think you're leaving out of the equation, is that, you know, when we think of immortality, quote unquote, like in the Hydra, these are organisms that can go back to prepubescent life right. cycles. And when we think about these long-lived animals, usually their age of reproduction is very different. Ours is quite young. I mean, it's not as young as many mammals, but it's quite young. And so just tinkering with a gene, and especially if you're already an adult when you do it, you know, if we're not talking about pre-implanting, I'm not sure that, you know, it's, you've got to remember that the machinery, just because you're changing the machinery doesn't mean the machinery hasn't been running the whole life.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. I mean, the benefits if they're proportional to what age you
right.
are when
you may exactly.
start
right.
repairing
you
me at 20 instead of 70. Please.
Exactly. You may need to
or
have this work
birth.
Done at 20 or younger
birth.
Or,
yeah,
or yeah, or that's fine as well, but it would
but
still.
But that's a massive ethical concern. It becomes a much more massive ethical concern when we're talking about making choices for people before they're ever born.
Which we do.
You're yeah. right. We do. But we do them usually to prevent suffering.
But the time's going to come. The time's going to come where that's going to be a realistic choice. And if a doctor came to me and said, I could make your kids, your child's genetic repair mechanisms so much more improved that they will have a healthy lifespan well past 100. And you know, this has been tested and it's reliable. I'll make that assumption at some point. We'll reach that. Would I do that for my kid? Yeah.
All right. Let's talk about something important, like cement.
Oh, wow.
Cement.
Cement
ever done for me?
Cement's a very important, critical material. That's one of the, I think, most common materials out of which we build stuff. You know, civilization is largely built out of concrete. Cement is a main ingredient of concrete, right? You make concrete out of cement. Cement is the binder, and concrete is when you add all the stuff to it, like the gravel and sand or whatever. So did you guys know that the production of cement is responsible for about 8% of the carbon dioxide?
Yes, we've talked about it being a big, big, big contributor.
Yeah, so it's the biggest contributor within the industry sector. So transportation is 29%. Electricity is 25%, industry is 23%, agriculture 10%, commercial and residential, basically everything else is 13%. So within that industry, you know, so 8% of the total is cement. And the CO2 comes from two sources. It's actually mostly from creating the energy to heat the lime to make the cement.
Okay. Really?
But also, because the lime is calcium carbonate, and that process releases CO2. But then when you cure the cement, that binds the CO2 back. I tried to answer the question, how much of the CO2 gets bound back in the concrete? And I couldn't come up with a definitive answer. But from what I could tell, it's about 80% of the CO2 is rebound
okay.
in that process. I think it has the capacity to hold 100%. So it basically like releases CO2 and then it could bind it all back again, but it just doesn't, you know. And in fact, some of the carbon dioxide is bound up during the curing process, but then over like a 50 or 100-year lifespan of the concrete, it continues to absorb more and more and more CO2.
Oh, okay.
But it never quite gets up to rebinding all the CO2 that was released. Does that make sense?
It's a net increase, but not that
yeah,
much.
Yeah.
Yeah. So most of it, like half of the CO2 from the cement industry is from the heating, the kilns. So you're burning fossil fuels to right. heat the kilns to cook the limestone. So that's
which
right.
is flexible.
Well, it is, but you know, for the next 30, 40 years, you know, anytime you anything that that causes more energy, some of that energy is going to be fossil fuel. You know, that's just the bottom line. So there are a couple. I'm going to talk about one in particular, but there's a couple that I came across when I was researching this, ways to try to mitigate this CO2 release from the cement industry, right? So one I came across today is called one is called concretine. What do you think that is?
Concretine?
Yeah.
One is what? What is called concretine?
One proposed solution to the CO2 release from concrete.
Okay,
or at least
so it's
mitigator.
Concrete mixed with.
Yeah, right.
With
concrete
something.
Mixed with.
It's a portmanteau, but of what? Concrete and.
Concrete and teen.
Poutine.
Poutine.
And graphene.
Oh, graphene. Yeah.
Oh,
yeah. Everybody
graphene.
Loves that graphene. Solving all the problems.
Yeah. So this doesn't actually prevent the need to heat the limestone. So what this does do. If you add, you know, graphene to the concrete mixture, which you can do, like, you can integrate this seamlessly into the existing concrete infrastructure. No, nothing special is needed. You just mix it in there, right?
Can we make that much graphene?
It makes it 30% stronger.
That's really? A lot.
It's
That's
a lot.
Pretty good.
Holy
shit.
Yeah.
yeah.
Yeah,
so, first of all, it makes it kind of kickstarts the curing process because it acts as like a nucleation site, I think, for the curing process. So, it makes it go faster and more thoroughly, and it makes it stronger. It sort of reinforces it. So, this could serve a few purposes. One is you can use 30% less concrete, you know, so in mm-hmm. that case.
Right.
You're just reducing the total demand of the cement, you know, that is going into the concrete by 30% or something like that, something close to that. May not be exactly a one for one. And that means that would reduce the
Less.
CO2 from the cement industry by 30% if we were replacing all of it with concretine. But you could also use cement without rebar. In some situations that you previously would have had to use rebar, so that could be an advantage there. It also would be less expensive. It costs 5% more, but it's you know the
right.
the net savings are 20%. I think is what they said, which makes sense. But it costs 5% more,
good.
But you're using 30% less. Whatever, like the net savings are 20%. So it's always good when a solution is also cheaper. You know,
right? What kind of graph?
You know, I tried to answer that very specific question exactly. What kind of graphene?
Yeah,
because
that's hard
the
to
only
scale
thing
up.
Every you know thing I read about this just said graphene. They mentioned the company that makes the graphene, but I couldn't find like exactly what the graphene is. But the thing is, it can't. They said they can mass produce it. It's like they could totally ready for prime time, ready to
really?
Go. Really? Yeah.
So it must be like an unrefined type of graphene.
Yeah. I mean, think about it, Bob. It doesn't have to be defect free. You know. It's,
right.
It's just a filler. It's just an internal kind of binding. Agent. So the concretine is also not only stronger; it has a longer lifespan, right? So it's less susceptible to being broken down or eroding. So there's that as well. So yeah, so I think that's interesting. It's one of these things. It sounds great on paper, and I don't see any reason why this
right.
wouldn't become a thing. You know, it's you know how scalable is it? You know, we make a lot of concrete, you know, in the world, and so I don't know how much of it, you know, this would be able to replace. But here's the other thing that I like about it is that it would be a way of sequestering carbon, right? Because that carbon that's being bound up in the concretine, and it's a significant amount by weight, you know, is that's long-term carbon storage. That's not going anywhere.
But where are they getting it from?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know that it really matters when you think about it. It's still taking it out of the carbon cycle. It doesn't matter if they're taking it from plant
suck it out of the atmosphere. That'd be cool.
Yeah, I mean, that'd be the direct way, sucking it directly out of the atmosphere. But even if they were making it ultimately from trees, okay, you know, that's
yeah.
wood that's not going to rot and release its carbon back into the atmosphere. It's going to be
gotcha.
Bound up. And so if we, you know, just make a a lot of concretine bind up a lot of carbon. I wonder like how much of an impact that itself can have. And that concrete over the next 50 to 100 years will continue to absorb carbon dioxide.
Keeps working.
Yeah, over time. So there, you know, this could, we think of it as a problem, right? But in fact, if done correctly, this could be part of the solution. The other one technology I came across is making concrete without cement. So this is a different approach. What? This is a Montreal company trying to make carbon negative concrete. So think about this.
Whoa.
Instead of using cement, right, and it's really the cement where you get the carbon, not the concrete, but the cement is what where you get the release of carbon, mm-hmm. in both the heating and from the calcium carbonate itself. They figured out a way to replace the cement in concrete with a new material that they source from steel slag.
Oh my God, a waste material? Nice.
Yeah, so this is the waste material from steel production, which is something that we make a lot of. So
wow.
Assuming there's a lot of steel slag.
What do they do with that slag now?
I don't know. That's a good question. So in this process, they grind it up, and then they replace cement in the concrete formula and mixture with this material. And this acts as the binding agent instead of the cement.
And it works just as well?
They said it works better. Like the product is actually a little bit better. And
what's the cost?
In fact, yeah, but the cost is good too because it's like they're using instead of making cement, you're just using a waste material.
So it's economically viable.
It's economically, yeah.
Oh my God.
That's key. That's a big part of that.
But think about this. So they said, so when you make concrete normally, it costs you, let's say, 2 units. You release 2 units of CO2 and then you reabsorb 1 unit. But it's actually only like 80% of 1 unit. But let's just say it's 1 unit, right? In this process, you don't release any CO2 because you're not making cement, and you just absorb the one. It still absorbs that 1 unit of CO2 when you cure it. So this is carbon negative concrete. So rather than it being a net release of 1 unit of carbon, it's a net absorption of 1 unit of carbon. So the more of this stuff that we make, this is another way of pulling carbon out of circulation and sequestering it. However, the one limitation that I came across in
research, it explodes after 50 years.
causes.
Yeah, whatever, right? We don't care about that now.
It builds up.
It's not after 50 years. It's at random. You can't predict it.
Total existence failure.
Total existence failure. No, is that it can only be made in molds. So I don't think you could, like, it sounds like it talks only about like making concrete blocks out of it. I guess you couldn't make a slab of it. Or a bridge out of it or something.
Well, that sucks.
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't able to find exactly why that is or get too into that, but they said very specifically, any cement that is formed, you know, that's made in a mold. So they talk about using this as a way to make cinder blocks.
Okay.
So still, it's another method. You know, you combine this with the other one, you know, maybe together they could take a huge chunk out of the CO2 release. Even if you get to carbon neutral between the two, that would be good. I mean, it's 8%, 8 to 10%. Actually, I read different figures. 8 to 10% of our total CO2 release is from this source. And that's a huge chunk of, that's like, you know, more than a third of the industrial release of CO2. If we could do that, if we could zero out transportation and electricity formation and cement, you know, we're getting close to like 60% reduction in CO2, 70% reduction in CO2.
When could we do that? If we really wanted to do it, Steve, how long do you think it would take?
To do all of that?
Yeah.
A long time. It's going to take, you know, 40 years to transfer the transportation sector entirely over to electric vehicles. It's going to take 30 years at least, I think, to transfer our energy production. And they're not even planning to do it. I mean, that's if we wanted to. China is like building coal-fired plants right now. Although they may not be adding total capacity, they're like replacing old ones, but still they're like resetting their coal-fired plant, you know, infrastructure. And then they said, yeah, in 2050, we'll start shifting over, you know, to renewable energy. It's like too late, dude. You can't do that 30 years from now. You've got to be doing that now. So again, it's just, it's not going to be.
Screwed.
We'll do it because it's cheaper, you know? It's already electricity, you know, solar panels are already the cheapest form of electricity. The problem is, you know, which I know I've discussed before, when you get higher penetration, then, you know, you need the intermittent part becomes a problem. Then you need to add either lots of overcapacity or you need an updated grid and or grid storage. Or you just keep our base load high, which means we're going to have to start replacing our nuclear infrastructure and you know, perhaps even expanding it. On that note, this is something separate, but I did read that one nuclear company did an analysis, and they said that their small modular nuclear reactors are now cost-effective to other baseload energy sources. So the nuclear industry is responding to the whole cost question by saying, all right, fine, we can produce nuclear power more cost-effectively, if that's like the big reason, the big limitation. And also a lot quicker because these are smaller installations. Yeah. So
no, let's build new coal plants.
Yeah, no, right. Let's build new coal plants. So we could. I think that it would be very difficult. I mean, 100% is going to be really hard. That last 20%, 30% is going to be so hard of CO2 production to get rid of. But here, think about it this way: if we could, fairly quickly, let's say within 20 years, pick the low-hanging fruit, get rid of, like, have our CO2 production or maybe reduce it by 60% by doing all the existing technology, cost-effective, relatively easy stuff, that would buy us time, right? That would buy us time, right? That would essentially double the time that we have to then take care of the more difficult problems. So the faster we pick the low-hanging fruit, the faster we reduce the CO2 production by leveraging existing technology, especially where it's cost-effective, the more time we will have to develop the technology we need to get that last 20 to 30%, which is going to be very difficult. So, but again, like the frustrating thing is, like, we have the technology.
What we
really don't have is a strategy, you know? And we don't have the political will to globally enact a strategy. And that's frustrating because it's like right there. You know, we just need to do it. But not going to happen.
We just suck it up and move away from the beach. Move away from the beach, people.
Suck it up and move away from water. Come on.
But that's where we are. And again, I hate to be, that's like that pessimistic thing again, Kara, right? But I hope I'm pleasantly surprised. I hope that somehow magically the political will appears. It can happen. I mean, there are things that have happened in our lifetime that we're like, oh, okay, that happened. You know, like.
Yeah, look, that pig is flying.
Well, we lived through like a complete sea change when it comes to acceptance of, you know, homosexuality, for example. Mm-hmm. When we were younger, politically, it was poison, you know, and now it's completely flipped in like 20 years, you know.
A generation, yes.
Yeah, in one generation. Like, we basically lived through that, you know. And not that it's not completely taken care of, but I mean, it's now it's political poison on the other side, you know what I mean?
Yeah. But also, that didn't just happen overnight.
No, I know that, but there was this, you know, just like the attitudes about climate change wouldn't just happen overnight. But the point is, there was a tipping point. Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. So if there's a political tipping point where suddenly the material will, the political will materializes, okay, I'll buy that can happen. It's just impossible to predict or to engineer to make it happen.
Make a plan around it, right?
Yeah.
Right.
And especially since it has to be global. If it were just the U.S., mm-hmm. I'm like, okay, that could happen in one election. You know, we could have a shift in the political will in the U.S., but worldwide, and it's, you know, China, it's not, I don't know. We can't make that happen. We can't engineer that. So there is good reason for pessimism, let me put it that way, politically. Technologically, we're there. We know what we could do it. We absolutely could do it.
And those are the sadder situation.
Frustrating.
Totally. Yeah.
Totally.
The really frustrating ones where it's like, we have a solution.
We do it.
In front of us.
Anyway, frustrating. All right, Bob, tell me about this super atomic level microscope.
All right. So Cornell researchers have achieved another coup with electron microscopy. being able to make images of atoms with twice the resolution as we've been able to do since 2018, when the same team pretty much had tripled the previous best resolution. So they are on a roll. This has now reduced atomic blurriness to a minimum that is possible using this technique. More on that statement later. So you think your iPhones take detailed pictures? How about 100 million times more detailed? This specific journey started in 2018. David Muller, the Samuel B. Eckert Professor of Engineering at Cornell, he and his colleagues tripled the resolution of atomic imagery using a transmission electron microscope and a technique called tichography. And they actually got into the Guinness Book, the sharpest image using electron microscope. So transmission electron microscope. That is, it's an awesome type of microscope. It does not use light to image tiny objects, but it uses a beam of electrons. And the beams are transmitted through a specimen to form the image, hence transmission electron microscope. And the electrons have much higher resolving power than light because their wavelengths are potentially 100,000 times shorter than visible light photons. Electrons are particles, yes, but they also have wavelengths as well. Please Google wave-particle duality if you are unfamiliar with that. So, tichography, what the hell is that? And that word starts with a P, tichography.
Like pterodactyl?
Right? P-T-Y.
Ptolemy?
Cography, C-H-O-G-R-A-P-H-Y. So, tichography is it's the application of special algorithms to extract information from the distorted image that this microscope creates. Now, light, like making sense of a picture taken in an evil clown house of mirrors. Now, I didn't necessarily need to have the clown in that analogy, but, you know, I wanted to have him in there anyway.
Evil clown is redundant, too.
Yes. There you go. The electron beam interacts with the atoms. They scatter, they diffract, they interfere, and ultimately creating an image like that cool speckle pattern. You know that the laser you played with your laser pen, that speckle pattern it makes when you shine it on the floor next to your cat?
Yeah, why is that?
Right? Because that's because you've got, you know, this pure laser light that is doing all sorts of sort of quantum stuff, but scattering and diffracting, I suppose. So this is similar, but different because you're using electrons, not lasers. So tichography looks at that raw image and enhances and sharpens it to look like it would have looked in order to create such a speckle pattern, right? Because you would need a specific arrangement or pattern of atoms that created the specific speckle pattern that was identified. So they go from there, the pattern, to use that information to create, this is what, you know, the arrangement of atoms had to have been in order to create it. So in 2018, it worked amazingly well. They tripled, like I said, they tripled the best resolution, that had up to that point. But there's a weakness here that the samples were very special that they used. They had to be extremely thin. Something like, some websites are saying only a few atoms thick. Essentially, it had to be a 2D material in order for this amazing, resolution to work. So that's cool, but it's also, that's a big downside. You know, what if you want to use a thicker sample? But the problem with the thick samples is that the scattering of the electrons were so complex that the tichography algorithms, to reconstruct the images of the atoms would not work. It's just way too complex. So this latest breakthrough, though, shows how to make the images even more accurate and work with a much thicker, truly three-dimensional samples. So as far as I could tell from reading the dense techno jargon of the paper, the improved tichography treats the thicker samples not as a unified whole, but as multiple thin slices. Because the electron beams essentially illuminate these discrete layers as the beam spreads and diffracts through the sample. So from these overlapping scattered patterns, they can infer lots of information and bring it all together, in terms of these atoms that are making up this three-dimensional, this thick material, much thicker than a two-dimensional material. So if you've seen any of the articles about this, the titles are almost invariably mention that this really amazingly high resolution, the highest we've ever achieved. And they should be very, very proud of this. I mean, they're down to the picometer, 1/1,000,000,000th of a meter scale resolution here. But really, how good is that? You know, can they double the resolution in a few years? You know, because they went from 2018, they tripled the resolution. Now in 2021, they doubled it again. So are they going to do that again? The answer there is basically no, they can't. But that's because this is essentially the highest resolution possible using an electron microscope. It really can't get much better. Why? Because the amount of blurring that's left in these atoms is almost entirely due to that little atomic jiggle that is there because basically of the existence of what we call temperature. You know, if you get rid of the temperature, then you maybe can stop it, but that's not going to happen, right? That's absolute zero. That's, you know, so what little blur there is basically impossible to remove, and that's where they are. But to be fair, you can improve it a little bit. If you use heavier atoms, the jiggle will be a little bit less, right? And if you decrease the temperature as far down as you can, that will increase it, increase the resolution as well, but not that much. It's not really worth that much. So Mueller said, this doesn't just set a new record. It's reached a regime which is effectively going to be an ultimate limit for resolution. We basically can now figure out where the atoms are in a very easy way. This opens up a whole lot of new measurement possibilities, things we've wanted to do for a very long time. And that very long time means since 1928. That's when Hans Bethe described that this multiple scattering problem would block the hyper-resolution images. And that's the problem that they have now solved. So what does this mean? You know, what can we do? Mueller says we want to apply this to everything we do. Until now, we've all been wearing these really bad glasses, and now we actually have a really good pair. So why wouldn't you want to take off the old glasses and put on the new ones and use them all the time, right? Sure, of course, use a new technology. So using this new method of electron tachography, scientists will be able to locate individual atoms within the three-dimensional sample. You know, some of those atoms, you know, as you get a three-dimensional sample, other imaging methods would not be able to detect some of those atoms because they'd be hidden because it's too big. Also, they can use this new method to image semiconductors, catalysts, quantum materials, like they were using in quantum computers like never before. Like I said, they could image thick biological tissues and even synaptic connections in the brain. Mueller calls that connectomics on demand. So are you happy about that, Steve?
Yeah, I love it.
Okay, so that's all I got. So that's it. Pretty cool. Very cool.
Neat.
You will be seeing more high-resolution atoms in your future.
Cool. Evan, you're going to finish us up with a follow-up on brain game what I like to call brain game pseudoscience.
Yep.
Does playing a brain game make you smarter?
Well, this report says that there is more evidence abound now showing that brain training games do not work as advertised. No surprise there. Just more evidence kind of going in that direction. Now, the question, of course, you ask in the beginning is, can a person train their brain by playing specific computerized games in order to enhance their general cognitive functioning? That's been a question that's been around for a while, and we've talked about it before. And one of the products we've talked about is Luminosity. Remember when we talked about that? FTC came.
I think it's Lumosity. Yeah,
oh,
Lumosity.
Yeah. No, I think it's, isn't it? I'm sorry, you're right. Yeah.
Luminosity is like candle, you know?
Yes, right. That's an actual
thing.
That's
like a real word, yeah.
Lumosity is a product I think we've spoken about before, probably one of the most well-known products of these products, and I don't remember we talked about it when the FTC came down and fined them millions of dollars for making unfounded claims and deceptive advertising. Well, there have been studies over the past decade that have put those claims to the scientific analysis, and there's a set of results in the news this week, which is reportedly the largest study to date, with 8,500 subjects in this study, and the results reinforce the body of evidence from prior studies that brain training games offer no benefit to a person's cognitive performance. The study was conducted by Bobby Stojanowski, who is a cognitive neuroscientist at Western University in Ontario. He and his staff, and their paper got published in the Journal of Experimental Psychology. It is titled, General Brain Training Habits Are Not Associated with Generalized Benefits to Cognition. The literature is replete with studies that use ill-defined criteria for establishing transferable improvements to cognition, often using single training and outcome measures with small samples. To overcome these limitations, we conducted a large-scale online study to examine whether practices and beliefs about brain training are associated with better cognition. We recruited a diverse sample of over 1,000 participants who had been using an assortment of brain training programs for up to 5 years. So there's 8,500 people in the study, but 1,000 of those people were using the brain training program for a significant amount of time. So they divided the two groups. They tested the 1,000 versus the other 7,500. Cognition was assessed using multiple tests that measure attention, reasoning, working memory, and planning, and we found no association between any measure of cognitive functioning and whether participants were currently brain training or not, even for the most committed brain trainers. And they said this was regardless of the participants' age, regardless of the amount of time they spent playing the games, regardless of their expectations of the outcome of the study or what they expected to get by doing the training, and regardless of their socioeconomic status. So, more of the same, essentially.
So I think the new bit that the authors are saying is this is a quote-unquote real-world, you know, environment to the study. Like they weren't.
Yeah, they're not saying, hey, go play this for 2 weeks and then we'll look at things and see what happens.
Yeah,
like, these people have been like doing it.
Doing it, you know, online, out in the world. And I don't want to gloss over that one very important word, generalized benefits to cognition.
Right.
That playing these games makes you better at the games
that
you're playing.
Game.
Yep.
Yeah. And not really beyond that, with maybe some very few exceptions.
Unless you play the game of life.
Well, the authors correctly conclude, you know, that if you know your time is much better spent practicing or training in things that are themselves useful. Right. If you want to learn to play the violin, practice the violin. You know what I mean? If you want to learn,
if you want to be really good at chess, keep playing chess. Sure.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But don't think it's going to make you smarter in other ways.
Right.
Yeah. Which the evidence for that is, you know, is just not there. It's just, again, it reinforces a prior body of research. This isn't a surprising finding.
Yep. Do a search, all though, right, for brain training games. You'll still see tons of products out there with all sorts of claims.
The industry's not going to fold up and go away because the research is not going their way.
Nope. So beware.
All right. Thanks, Evan. Well, everyone, we're going to take a quick break from our show to talk about our sponsor this week, The Great Courses Plus.
Guys, you know we love The Great Courses. That's because we love to learn, and this is a great place to go if you want to learn things.
Yeah, with The Great Courses Plus, you'll get thousands of hours of fascinating content across hundreds of topics. You've got access to video, audio, and guidebooks, and of course, there's new content added every month. My favorite part, you can watch or listen anywhere at any time with The Great Courses Plus apps, and yeah, it's ready for you on the go.
Hey guys, I'm going through one of their courses, examining the big questions of time. Not the little questions, the big questions of time. The myth of the beginning of time. Is time an illusion? All about atomic clocks. The atoms of space and time. What does that mean? And also, of course, could time end? Where they explore, you know, what the equations of modern physics tell us about the possibility of time actually ending. Fascinating stuff. Can't wait for more chapters. Check it out.
Don't miss out on this great deal. Go now to thegreatcoursesplus.com/skeptics to get your free trial. And SGU listeners will also get 20% off the annual membership. Again, that's thegreatcoursesplus.com/skeptics.
All right, guys, let's get back to the show. Jay, it's Who's That Noisy time.
All right, guys, last week I played this noisy. And here it is, slowed down. So what do you guys think that is?
It sounds like something being impacted. In other words, one thing hitting another thing. But I don't know exactly what it is.
Anybody else?
Boing.
That's very technical, Kara.
Thank you.
I have one correction this week. This was sent in by a listener named Daryl Goosen. And Daryl sent in a guess for this week's noisy, but then he said, P.S., my 12-year-old son wants to point out that the Nintendo sound played on episode number 821 and answered on 822 was not the Wii Home theme, but the Mii Maker theme song.
It's when you make your little person to look like you.
Oh. Yeah, so if anybody disagrees or wants to confirm that, email me at WTN@theskepticsguide.org, but either way, I think it's cool that a 12-year-old is listening and that they made a correction on a science and critical thinking podcast. So thanks for that. Don't be hesitating to send in more corrections, anybody out there, because we like it. A listener named Jason Brown wrote in and said, hey, my first Who's That Noisy guest, because I got this. It's a medieval blacksmith forging a broadsword. That is really cool. That is not correct, but Steve appreciates that entry because Steve loves sword making. I know my brother. next,
what kind of steel was it though? Was it, you know, was it 1095? Was it spring steel? I've got to get more specific.
This next one was sent in by Visto Tutti. Who is this guy? Is he even one person or is he multiple people? Nobody knows. He guessed, I hear a man give a command twice. Sounds like Urup Sai, S-E-A, which I cannot translate. Then a percussive strike on a metallic object of some mass. Wild guess. Testing bridge strength from the sound they make, which I thought was provocative. You know, I don't know how they would be making the bridge make sound, but you know, that could, I don't know.
Are you provoked?
I am provoked. That is not correct. I will move on. We have a listener named Shane Hillier, and he says, hey, Jay, I love the show and I've listened since 09-ish, I think. This felt like some kind of ceremony where some dude shoots at a bell.
I love that one too.
Yep. No, nobody is shooting at a bell, but man, now I need to hear that. I'm sure it's on the internet. I'll have to go look for that. We have a winner. It's not that common that the very first email sent about a particular round of Who's That Noisy is the correct one, but this happened this week. All right, so we have a listener this week. The listener's name is John Erickson, and John wrote in, salutations, Jay and crew. Love the channel, been listening for years, yada, yada, yada. Who's That Noisy from episode 828 is an anvil being sent into the air by an explosion in a steel box with a small opening at the top that the anvil was placed over. The video is from the YouTube channel Beyond the Press by Lori and Annie. Whoa, I can't pronounce that last name. Vohensilta from Finland. Wow, that's a cool name. Anyway, very cool noise. I love listening to it slow as well because you get to really hear some of the details that are in there. So go do listen to it again on your own if you have a chance. That was an awesome guest. Thank you, John. I thought it was a really cool sound and visually it's very cool. You can take a look at that. It's on the web. I have a new noisy this week, and this noisy was sent in by a listener named Vanessa Landsteit. All right, and here it is. Huh, sounds familiar, huh?
Yes, I've heard that song before.
Or have you, though? Have you heard that song before?
Oh, maybe that wasn't Jim Morrison in the Doors?
So tell me what you just heard. That's what I want to know. You can email me at WTN@theskepticsguide.org.
All right, thanks, Jay. All right, guys, let's go on with our interview. We are joined now by Mick West. Mick, welcome to The Skeptic's Guide.
I'm very glad to be here.
So, Mick, you are the founder of metabunk.org, which is a website, a forum all about debunking conspiracy theories, and the author of the book Escaping the Rabbit Hole, How to Debunk Conspiracy Theories Using Facts, Logic, and Respect. But we're talking to you tonight because you're also the author of a number of videos analyzing this recent spate of Pentagon videos showing what they are calling UAPs, or unidentified aerial phenomena. And as we were just chatting about before we started recording, you're the man of the hour now, right? Everyone wants to talk to you and explain, which is good because, you know, a lot of the programs I'm watching are not interviewing any skeptics. They're just gullibly saying, ooh, look at this, aliens. So tell us about your involvement with the UAP videos.
Sure. Well, it kind of started about 4 years ago now, I'd say. I used to be a kind of a general purpose debunker, and I would do chemtrails a lot. And then I did some stuff like 9/11 conspiracies, and I've done election fraud conspiracies. And I was never really that into the UFO thing. But about 4 years ago, this video came out from Chile, from the Chilean Navy And they basically, like, they presented this video as being a UFO, and, you know, I was one of the guys who kind of looked into it, and, it actually was a crossover thing because it had these trails coming out of the back, which I recognized as being contrails, and being a contrail expert from my chemtrail work, I kind of leapt onto that and really got into it, and I found I really enjoyed analyzing UFO videos. And then shortly after that, we had these three videos coming out from the US Navy. And so I started getting my teeth into those and figuring out what was going on there.
So what kind of analysis did you do of these videos?
Well, essentially, I used to be a video game programmer. And you know, when you do video games, you're taking like a model of the 3D world. You've got the 3D coordinates, and then you're transforming them into screen coordinates, into 2D coordinates. And when you're analyzing a video of a UFO or a plane or something like that, you're kind of doing the same thing, but in reverse. You are taking the 2D coordinates on screen, the 2D image, and the way that image changes over time. And you're trying to kind of figure out the reverse transform to figure out what the actual real world model is that's actually happening. So you're looking at something like a dot that's way in the distance. You don't know if it's small or far away. So you've got to be able to try to figure out which one of those fits the available facts best. So it ties in a lot with my video game programming. And then it also ties in with something I was really good at in video games, which was debugging, because of course my code had lots of bugs, and all code has lots of bugs. And when you're debugging a video game, especially back when I was making them, back in the, you know, the PlayStation days, when they came on CDs, you couldn't actually change them after they had shipped. So once you've actually started selling the game, there was no way of changing it. You know, it's like you get a book, you can't change your typos once it's in the hardback. And so you had to get really, really good at getting to the root cause of things. And so I was doing this essential root cause analysis on exactly what's going on. And you just kind of get your teeth into it, and you can't let go until you figure it out.
And there's a lot of information on these videos, you know, because they're often cockpit cameras, et cetera. So there's a lot of technical, like, metadata that you can get from the video. It's not just a picture of the blob in the distance. There's some details there.
Yeah, and the more data you have, the better, obviously. Like, you know, the ideal thing to have is the location of the camera and the direction it's pointing in and the field of view. But sometimes you don't have those things. But in these videos, we have the heading of the camera relative to the plane. We have the angle that the camera is pointing at, like up or down. In one of the videos, we have a range, which is the distance to the object itself, the straight line distance.
How was that determined? Because to me, that's one of the most critical bits of information. You know, how far away is it? Is it small and close and therefore moving slowly? Or is it big and far away and therefore moving, you know, amazingly fast, beyond physics fast? So is it very common to have distance data? I don't think it's very common.
Yeah, only one of the videos actually has a range number, and that's actually determined by radar. There's two basic ways. There's radar or there's laser range finding. And either one is just going to give you a number on screen, but they're using radar to track it on one. But in the other videos, we don't actually have the range data. So it makes it a lot more challenging. You have to kind of use that as a variable and see which version of that distance works best. And you end up with, like, say, different size planes. If you're thinking it's a plane, it could be a small jet or it could be like a 747. And then you have to take other things into account as well as that. So yeah, you look at all the data on the screen, you look at the image itself, and you try to recreate what actually fits best. And it's quite complicated. It's surprisingly complicated sometimes. So yeah, when I explain it, I break it down in a very, very simple way, but I often have to leave out a huge amount of the analysis that I've done, just because I don't have time to discuss it.
And so pick one of the videos and just to give us a quickie, like the quick version of what did you find? Like, what was your analysis and how did that lead you to your conclusion?
Well, let's take the GoFast video. It's kind of like the simplest one to talk about. At the start of the GoFast video, you see what looks like a very, very fast moving object. It's a little white dot, and it looks like it's moving really, really fast over the surface of the ocean. And then the camera locks onto this object and it starts tracking it, and it looks like it's tracking it really, really fast. And, you know, it actually looks like it's going something around like 300 or 400 knots, like, you know, 2/3 the speed of sound. So it's really, really fast. But then you start to look at the other things besides the simple image itself. You look at the numbers on the screen, and you've got the two important ones, the one I mentioned, the range. Once it acquires the target, it actually gets a radar range. And then you've also got the heading angle relative to the plane, and you've got the slant angle, which is the angle downwards. And if you know what your altitude is, which is also on screen, it was 25,000 feet, and you know what angle you're pointing down, and you know how far away something is, that distance becomes the hypotenuse of a right angle triangle. And the angle is just the angle down. So the opposite leg of that triangle, which is the vertical height below where you are, is the sine of the angle multiplied by that range. So it's just multiplying two numbers together, and it tells you what the altitude of that other object is relative to you. Then you subtract them, and it turns out it's not actually down by the ocean. It turns out it's actually quite high up. It's actually halfway between you and the ocean, almost exactly halfway.
Mm-hmm. Oh, great.
And you could estimate its actual relative speed with the same method, and it's like not going that fast.
A similar method, yeah. What I had did was I did a graphical way of solving that, because it's kind of a tricky thing to do analytically, because it's difficult to convey what you're actually doing. So I did essentially a vector diagram using the angle and range at the start and the angle and range at the end, which is the angle from the front of the plane. And then the bank angle of the plane, I used that and calculated from the bank angle of the plane how fast the plane should be turning left or right. And then created a kind of a vector diagram, which told you where the target was at the start and then where the target was at the end. And then the distance between those two points is the velocity when you divide by time. So it's mathematically that would have been very complicated to describe with an equation, but it actually turns out to be fairly simple to do graphically, and it's much more accessible to people.
Right, and so and then the end result of all of that was what?
The end result of that was that the object was moving at about 40 knots, plus or minus like 20 knots, which essentially is about the same as wind speed at that altitude. Mm-hmm. And so now you know you've got something that's moving at wind speed. And you know from the infrared camera that it's cold because it appears as a white dot and the camera's in black hot mode. So anything that's hot would appear black. So you think, you know, what's
drifting in the wind?
What is cold? What's drifting in the wind? What could it possibly be? It's the most likely thing is a balloon. Yeah. And not just that, a weather balloon, because you get a very good solid radar lock. And weather balloons carry this little radar reflector so planes don't bump into them. So everything fit. Everything kind of lined up. And I just kind of published this result and UFO people started shouting at me.
Yeah, but as far as I could see, no one's been able to do any kind of real response to that. Like no one's has any valid criticism of your methods.
Yeah, that's true. And I think part of the problem here is that the people who are releasing these videos really aren't doing any analysis on them. And they're just kind of saying, hey, look, it looks like it's moving really fast. And then they stick it out there and they do some kind of naive calculations, kind of assuming that it is moving really fast and it is down by the surface of the ocean. But they don't actually get into the nitty-gritty details. And so they kind of come up with almost like the answer that they're looking for rather than the actual answer.
Oh, sure.
Imagine.
And is the military, do they have any analysts doing what you're doing here? I mean,
I'm sure they do. Like the problem is that the military don't want to talk about this, partly because this is a classified system that these are recorded on. It's called the Raytheon Atlas system. And it's, you know, fairly advanced targeting pod that straps on the underneath of the planes. And if you look for, example videos shot with this on YouTube, you will find basically nothing, like a few really grainy ones. Because even though I'm sure there's tens of thousands of hours that have been shot with it, it's all classified. So they don't want to talk about it. And if they do analysis of it, that becomes classified by default. And so they're not going to release it. And they've actually explicitly said that they do not plan to release the results of the investigation into these videos.
Yeah, but couldn't they release information analysis similar to what you have released? I mean, you're not, you know, breaking any national security laws by what you're saying. Can't they do something similar that's not compromising national security?
They could, but technically the results of an investigation that include classified materials get the same classification level as that classified material unless separately declassified. So they would have to jump through a bunch of hoops to even
bother,
just release.
Why bother?
Yeah. Yeah, but
instead, let's just make sure the entire, you know, population is up in arms and stressed out. I mean, that's the frustrating part. It's like, can we just calm people
right? And they're not thinking that, oh, look at, these are aliens, because that's kind of like whatever, you know. Yeah, they're aliens, but a lot of people are thinking, well, it's either aliens or it's some other country that has this hyper advanced technology, and we need to be on alert and do. And that's where it gets actually, you know, it could have some serious ramifications.
And the Department of Defense is going to be issuing a report to the United States Senate next month in regards to this video and others about this phenomenon. What are we to make of that, in the sense that how is that report going to be made to the Senate without the general public kind of knowing exactly what is going on here and what has been analyzed?
Yeah, the report really isn't about these videos. It's kind of a general report about the UAP investigations within the military. So it's basically a grand overview of everything the military is doing to study UAP. So, you know, in theory, it could include all the other videos that are supposedly out there and every single report that's ever been given by a Navy airman. So it's not trying to clear these particular videos up. It's trying to get some kind of overview of what's actually going on with UAP investigations, which is a very strange and twisted tale. What's actually going on with these UAPs? There's a great article by Jason Colavito that came out a few days ago that kind of examines the history of the people involved in this and why we've got a UFO studying program within the military in the first place. And it kind of boils down to essentially there are people who are kind of UFO fans and to a certain degree paranormal fans, and have got a little bit of a toehold in the government.
Mm-hmm. Shocker! Yes.
Does that explain why, when like even though they can't like release a detailed analysis of classified information, when they go on like this week or on the news shows, somebody from the Pentagon or in the military who's familiar with the program, they make all these coy statements like, we don't know what it is, and it's very interesting, and whatever. Why couldn't they just say, yeah, you know, we can't go into the details because it's classified, but we've analyzed this, and there's nothing, no reason to think these are anything other than mundane objects. But they don't make statements like that. They're perpetuating the mystery.
Well, the people you're seeing on these shows are not actually from the Pentagon. They're people who have retired or left the Pentagon, like former people. The main guy is Lou Elizondo, who ran this program.
Oh, God. Yeah, we know him.
Some time ago. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yep. And he...
So they have their own agenda. If these people were actually actively working here, they wouldn't be able to go on these shows.
Yeah, the Pentagon said nothing. They haven't said anything at all about this, other than that these videos were taken and that a UAP task force exists. So if you look at, you're looking for official statements, there's basically nothing out there. You got a few politicians saying things like Marco Rubio.
Yeah, right.
We don't know what his motivation is. It could just be like he just, you know, he sees it as a popular thing to talk about and he's talking about it. Or maybe he's being convinced by something he's seen behind the scenes. He's the ranking minority member of the House Committee on Intelligence. There's nothing coming out of the Pentagon, but yet you hear these stories like Pentagon admits UFOs are real.
Yeah.
When they haven't.
Yeah.
Well, and do you guys remember when we visited the CIA, one of the things that we talked about when we were in that kind of room, you know, discussing SCICOM and different approaches, was the frustration that these CIA officers feel, being like, it's really hard to calm the general public when we're not allowed to disclose anything.
Mm-hmm.
Like when something is classified, but so we can't tell them anything because it's classified, when all we really want to do is say, don't worry. How do we get them to trust us if we can't give them any evidence for why they shouldn't worry? And it sounds like that's sort of the unfortunate position that the Pentagon's in right now.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And you can kind of almost feel that when you talk to the spokespeople. They just give these boilerplate answers. But you can kind of tell there's you know, they know more about what's actually going on, and they probably would like to clear things up. But because you've got this huge bureaucracy and this huge system of classification by default, they just can't get past it.
But if you remember, I don't know that this is going on now, but just for completeness, in the 1990s, the Air Force essentially admitted that they allowed UFO reports to simmer and and they deliberately didn't debunk them. Yeah, because it was cover, because a lot of the sightings were of secret military craft that were being researched. So if the public is being distracted by all this, you know, alien talk, that's a good thing in their book. At least they admitted that in the 1990s. Again, I don't know if that's still their policy, but...
Oh my gosh, they've been doing it since Project Mogul in 1947. Exactly. That was the original case of it.
Yeah, it definitely almost feels like a Cold War era kind of, you know, utilization. Like, I guess it would still be relevant now, but for sure, I buy it in the 90s or post-90s.
Yeah, so I don't know if it's relevant now, but we don't know that they really want to clear it up. They may not really care.
Yeah, you know? Yeah, it's like... What is their motivation right now? What does the military get out of clearing it up?
You know, right
now, yeah, they don't really have any.
Yeah.
Yeah. So they just
I just feel like trust in our, you know, trust in our government agencies is like at an all-time low. Just public trust in reason and evidence and authority is at an all-time low. You would think that that might be motivation.
But if they did, if they did come out and say these were nothing, would that increase trust in the Pentagon? I don't know that it would.
True.
Well, that's the rub.
But couldn't they cite just one example and give us the evidence for one case? Say, for example, here's this case, here's the evidence, and here's why it's not what it's being claimed it is. And just present that and say, okay, so we're being totally honest with you. Just one time, example.
Mick, how many videos did you look at?
I've looked at lots of videos, but there's five videos from the Navy. There's those three that you mentioned earlier, the three black and white ones. And then there's another one called the Green Pyramid video. And then there's the Omaha Sphere video. And this Green Pyramid video is particularly interesting. It's this flashing green pyramid. But again, like, you know, you kind of analyze it. And my analysis there was essentially looking at it and saying, oh, I recognize that. And, you know, it looks like the flashing lights of a plane. And then why is it triangular? Well, it's out of focus. And they're filming it with a camera that has a triangular aperture.
Yep,
and creating triangular bokeh.
Mick, I know we don't have access to these, but do you have any opinions about... Because the other thing that people bring up is, what about the radar? So, the pilots are seeing... these blobs in the distance, but they're also being spotted on radar and infrared. So that can't be a balloon or a bird. What do you make of that?
Well, you know, there's that guy who says he saw them every day for 2 years. But if the Navy actually saw something flying in restricted airspace for 2 years, you'd think they would have figured it out by now. They think they would have figured it out within a week because, you know, it's a serious issue if something is unidentified flying in the airspace. But when he talks about it, when he says seeing, what he's really talking about is seeing it on the radar. And then he talks about how they would fly up to it and they would look for it. And he was saying when he got there, he got to this thing called merge plot where they look like they're in the same position. They wouldn't see anything. And so there was kind of nothing there.
It's cloaked. It's cloaked.
Yeah. And then there's other things that release photographs of things. And they look like balloons. They look like party balloons and things like that. So it's just stuff floating around in the air. Yeah, they're off the coast of – on the East Coast somewhere where it's quite densely populated. And, you know, things go up in the air and fly around. And sometimes things will show up on the infrared as well. But if something was really there, they would be able to intercept it. And they haven't. They just have these kind of reports of things without anything actually coming up.
Yeah, that's what I keep pointing out. It's like, remember, we're still looking at blobs and blips and lights. Like, there's no one is coming up on a craft. On something that's like demonstrably, unambiguously a flying craft or an alien.
Yeah,
it's just we're still looking at blobs. And the reason that we're looking at blobs is because anything that's not a blob is something mundane.
Exactly. Right. Yeah, it's like everything stays at exactly the right distance for whatever camera you have to be just beyond its resolving capabilities. I call it the low information zone that UFOs like to live in, which depends on the circumstances, like the lighting circumstances and what camera you have and other factors like that. Yeah, they always just stay just a little bit too far away.
Yeah, imagine we finally see an alien craft and it is, by its very nature, blurry and distinct. Like, it's like blobs watch.
I think Bigfoot is blurry. Smart. That's crazy.
That's an excuse that gets used. They have a thing called the five observables characteristics of UFOs, like super speed and maneuverability. And the fifth one is low observability.
What?
They actually use that as a semi-official within this task force, like criteria for judging whether something is a UFO. If it's difficult to see, if it's difficult to observe these other four observables, then it's a UFO, which is a bit of a cheat, really, I think.
Yeah.
Oh, it's totally a cheat. Yeah.
And it's a tautology. It's like this is why they're unidentified.
Yep. Yeah.
Because they're in that zone. You circular were just
and to clarify, I mean, the thing is, UFO means unidentified flying object.
Yeah,
we know that.
By definition.
But most people still use that as shorthand for aliens.
They do, yeah.
Right. And that's why, is that why you have been saying UAV,
UAP,
unidentified
UAP
aerial
is, that's the new Pentagon terminology.
So. Yeah. Yeah, it comes from the UK, and it's supposed to kind of legitimize things a little bit.
I know.
But it really is just, it will take on the same associations as UFO eventually, because they're talking about the same things.
For now, though, UFO's got too much baggage. It's good to switch to another initialism.
Right. It doesn't work, though. Like, they did that with cold fusion.
For a little while.
It's low-energy nuclear reaction. It's LENR. It's cold fusion. Shut up. It's just saying, like, UAPs, it's UFOs. It's the same thing. You just.
But I like it. I like not using another term. I like that. For a little while, it's a little bit better because it doesn't have the baggage yet of UFO.
It's true, because when we say UFO, people go, yeah, it's an alien.
Yeah.
Right.
Like,
they think
I literally
saucer.
Just. They think flying saucer. Like, I just posted your story about this, Steve, on Twitter, and it was kind of funny because it was like, you know, the UFO thing, it's a bunch of nothing. And of course, all my skeptical followers are like, you mean it's not unidentified? And it's like, no, it is. It is.
Yeah.
It's not aliens. That's
it's too
what I
tainted
mean.
At this point.
Yeah, the UFO people get kind of annoyed because they're trying desperately to be legit. And so they don't like using the term UFO. And they don't even like talking about aliens. Like, if I ever bring up aliens, they're like, hey, who mentioned aliens? What's going on here? I didn't say aliens. Did you say aliens?
Oh, yeah, really?
Yeah, so they're trying to frame the discussion in a way that allows it to proceed without ridicule, which is fair enough.
The intelligent designers. We're not talking about God. No one mentioned God. Yeah. It's just the intelligent designer. So it's the same strategies across all these pseudosciences where they're living in the unobservable, ambiguous zone. They're trying to shift terminology. They're being coy. Some of them, you know, the ones that are trying to be respectful, then you get the real nutjobs who are like saying, yes, the information was beamed down to me by an alien. You know, like they're just explicit about it. But those are like the fringe. You have the people trying to go mainstream or they think that being coy, wink, wink, nod, nod is going to get them there. But it's the same stuff over and over again.
What's the psychological motivation here? Is it to be on the inside? Is it to have that sort of like weight to say, oh, I know something you don't know?
It's all that. Okay. It's so life isn't dull and boring. You know, that's motivation enough.
Yeah. I think people, they're just essentially UFO fans. I mean, it sounds a bit simplistic, but they really like the idea of UFOs visiting, of aliens visiting, essentially. People who are science fiction fans, like I was when I was a kid. And, you know, to a certain degree, they don't grow out of their childhood fascination with science fiction. And it manifests in this desire for UFOs to actually be aliens.
And the weird other side of that coin is the fact that we know, using probability and statistics, we know that there's life out there somewhere in the universe, for sure, perhaps even in our own solar system, at the very least if it's microbial-like. But so we know that there's life out there somewhere. There's too many stars and planets. But
that's not the question.
But we know that there's aliens out there, but we also know, no, there's no evidence that they visited the Earth. It's just too far away.
So you're not expecting any big revelations in June when the Pentagon gives its report to the Congress?
No, not really. And I think it kind of depends who's actually writing this report and how many people are working on it and how seriously they take it. It may just be some kind of like a list of things that have happened and various reporting protocols, like how does the Navy report unidentified objects? But I certainly don't expect any big revelations about anything, even like advanced technology. I think it's just going to be more of the same. The interesting stuff is going to be classified. It's probably not that interesting anyway, but we're not going to hear about it because it's technology that we don't let the public know about. And it'll just be kind of a nothing burger, and the UFO community is going to be disappointed and probably start saying there's a big cover-up.
Sure. Yeah, it's an endless cycle. All right, Mick, well, thanks for joining us and straightening us all out on these videos. We appreciate it.
Well, thank you very much. I enjoyed being here.
And thanks for all your good work. It's always important out there to have people who are like getting their hands dirty, doing all the really technical, detailed work of analyzing videos like this. Like, we report on it, but I don't have hours and hours to spend or whatever it took to dive into. We need the technical people to do that for us, so thanks.
You're welcome. It's a lot of fun, actually.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fake. Then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. You have three regular news items this week. You guys ready?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
All right, here we go. Item number one, astronomers find that 36 nearby dwarf galaxies, separated by as much as 13 million light years, experienced a simultaneous significant decrease 6 billion years ago, followed by an increase 3 billion years ago in star formation. Item number two, a new review finds that the greatest risk from current self-driving cars is failure or errors of their sensing systems. And item number three, a new study finds that the introduction of ride-sharing services into a U.S. city reduces sexual assault by 6.3%. Kara, you weren't here last week, so you go first.
Mean? Okay, let me read them.
Hey, just be all lucky right. You weren't here last week. I had those picked out especially for you, and you missed them.
Ah, nice. Were they all astro?
They were tech. They were all tech.
Oh, gotcha. 36 nearby dwarf galaxies, 13 million light years separation, simultaneous significant decrease. What does that mean, decrease? Decrease in what?
In star formation. I know it's kind of a long sentence, so just to clarify.
Okay. Yeah,
you
got to get to the end.
6 billion years ago, all 36 galaxies had a significant reduction in their star formation. And then 3 billion years later, they all had a significant increase in their star formation.
So basically something would have been acting on them that was cosmic. That was way bigger.
All 36 galaxies separated by 13 million years were synchronized in this way.
Yeah, which probably even more things would have been, if that is science. A review finds that the greatest risk from current self-driving cars is failure or errors of their sensing systems. That seems like it could definitely be science, because you're like, let me just make this one up. And what are all the Teslas that like thought they saw a cloud, but really it was a car, or they thought they saw a car, but really it was a cloud, whatever. And that's why they crashed. And then a new study finds, fill in the blank. Yes, a new study finds everything. But let's see, the introduction of ride sharing services into a U.S. city reduces sexual assault by 6.3%. That's like not even a significant amount. I don't know. Don't Uber drivers, isn't there like a not insignificant number of sexual assaults that are like committed by the drivers in ride sharing? I feel like that's an actual thing. These could all be science and they could all be fiction. Only one is the fiction. I think it's the ride-sharing one. That's the fiction. Just because I think sexual assaults are awful and they're going to happen regardless of if women have a ride home from a random stranger.
Okay, Bob.
Let's see. The dwarf one, 36 dwarf galaxies. I mean, this is just too crazy. What could it impact them? I mean, they got a separation of how many millions of light years? 12 million light years? 13
up to
million
13.
Light years? Huge. I mean, maybe it's a byproduct of the way their formation. Their kind of central supermassive black hole. I'm not sure. I don't think that's made up. Just a self-driving one, errors in the sensing systems. I mean, it seems obvious, maybe too obvious, but I'll agree with Kara on this one that the sexual assault reduction with ride sharing going down. I'll say that's fiction.
Okay. Evan?
I'll break ranks. I think the self-driving car's failure about the sensing systems is the fiction. I think the greatest risk from self-driving cars has something more to do with human error, because, you know, I think generally speaking, when it comes to machines and things, human error is like the first thing you always look for. So a human somehow is doing something wrong, pressing a wrong button or somehow interfering with the regular functioning of the self-driving car. And I think that's the greatest risk and failure. And errors there.
And Jay?
I don't think that with the second one here, a great risk from current self-driving cars is a failure. It's the sensing system, right? It's not the driving system. It's the sensing system. Well, of course it's the sensing system. That is the harder of the two systems if there is a problem. And that is the reason why right now we don't have self-driving cars all over the place, is because of that. All right. So I guess that's science then, because that's got to be the reason why they're not deploying these immediately. So that means that I think that the fiction is going to be the ride-sharing one.
All right, so you all agree on the first one, so we'll start there. Astronomers find that 36 nearby dwarf galaxies, separated by as much as 13 million light years, experienced a simultaneous significant decrease 6 billion years ago, followed by an increase 3 billion years ago in star formation. You guys all think this one is science, and this one is science.
Ooh, okay,
this is cool.
Yeah, that's how did weird, that happen? Yeah.
What's we have theory? No freaking idea. As far as I
a
can
happy
tell,
coincidence.
They're like, you know, this is an observation and they got nothing. So they don't know of any way, anything. So usually star formation is triggered, you know, by, you know, is affected by the density of the hydrogen gas clouds, by nearby supernova, by some kind of disturbance, you know, in those gas clouds, some kind of gravitational thing, galaxies colliding or whatever. But why would such widely dispersed galaxies all sort of synchronize? That implies there's some effect going on that is 13 million light years across, at least. They just don't know what it is. They just have no idea what it
is.
That's
cool.
Yeah. So that's interesting. So maybe we'll keep an eye on that and see what hypotheses come out of it.
Maybe we could figure it out in a few billion years.
Yeah. All right, so let's go to number two. A new review finds that the greatest risk from current self-driving cars is failure or errors of their sensing system. Evan, you are all by your lonesome out on a limb.
As I'm
that
wont
this
to
one
do sometimes.
Is
oh,
efficient.
Wait, Jay didn't go with Evan?
No.
No.
Oh, I thought he did.
Everyone else went with
I want to be with Evan right now. I think he's right.
Oh, gosh.
And this one is... the fiction. Good job, Evan.
Yeah, good job,
human
Evan.
Error?
If so, you had gone before me, I think I would have gone with you.
So there is no study or review. I just made it up, but...
I even said that. I was like, you could have just made this one up.
I did look up like just one of the most common ones, you know, just to make sure that I wasn't accidentally giving you a correct answer. And I didn't find any list of risks of self-driving cars that even mentioned the sensing systems. So here's one that this is from technology.org, and they have their top five. Danger number one, an unregulated industry. Basically, the regulations are not keeping up with the technology, and therefore that could create problems. Number two, accidents from blending human and self-driving cars. That's a human error thing.
Yeah.
So Evan, you mentioned that. Number three, vulnerability to hacking and remote control.
Ooh, scary thought.
Number four, computer malfunctions. So you know how many computers there are in a self-driving car?
Two.
About two.
Jay. nice, Jay.
Between 30 and 100 computers.
I win.
Whoa.
All with their own software that can have glitches and can crash. And so the...
Jeez, give me the 30 instead of the 100.
You got to have... A lot of redundancy built in there. And think how often, like every time your computer crashes, does your car crash? I mean, that's like, you got to think about that, right?
Blue screen pops up. Ah.
Yeah, just restart on the freeway.
And number five, which I think is total BS, they have exposure to radiation for like all the GPS and remote controls and Wi-Fi and Bluetooth. But that's nonsense.
Oh my gosh.
They talk about like EMF.
Radiation?
Yeah, so I don't agree with that one. So, but yeah, that was it. So those are the ones that I kept coming across in multiple sources. I think the sensors are fine. I don't think that that's a weak link in the system. So all of this means that a new study finds that the introduction of ride-sharing services into a U.S. city reduces sexual assault by 6.3% is science. In fact, there were several correlations here that were interesting. So the more unsafe the neighborhood, the greater the benefit of having ride-sharing services, and also the less the availability of public transport, the greater the benefit. Mm. The 6.3% was sort of an average just in U.S. cities. And the very reason is because you can call a car and get a ride home and not have to walk home through a dangerous neighborhood or alone or whatever. So it just reduces the opportunity. And you know, the study was done partly because ride-sharing services have garnered a reputation for sexual assault, you know, as part of the ride-sharing experience. And they wanted to know, like, how big a phenomenon is this? And in fact, the net effect was that it reduced it. It doesn't mean it's not happening. It's just that it's reducing it by more, 6.3% more than any incidents happening with ride-sharing. And I don't know if there's hard data on this, but there's certainly a lot of discussion about ride-sharing companies being better at vetting their drivers or monitoring. I don't know if that's true. What do you think about that? Have you heard anything about that, Kara? Are they getting better?
I hope so. I mean, just from a liability perspective, it would make sense for them to do more background checking. And
I mean, there's a round of criticism and them vowing to do better. I don't know if they've actually done better, but hopefully they have. So I mean, that's good. It's good to know that there's a public service aspect to the ride sharing services here that are positive. All right, good job, Evans. I was smiling to myself when you were striking out on your own. You have a history of doing that just at the right time.
It feels good once in a while. It does. Not always.
Be brave. Be brave. Don't follow the herd.
That's right.
All right, Evan, give us a quote.
A very good theory will be one that makes very wide-ranging claims about the world, and which is consequently highly falsifiable, and is one that resists falsification whenever it is put to the test. That was written by Alan F. Chalmers from his book, What is This Thing Called Science?
Yeah, cool. That's kind of a basic concept, but it's very, very important. Yeah,
it is. And that book was written in 1976. I'm surprised I had not heard of it before. And it was an attempt to introduce basically the lay public to how science really works.
Mm-hmm.
It's probably something I should go back and read.
Yeah. I mean, I assume there's a ton of books out there that are great that we just never heard of. I think, and probably every generation has like the same good science books over and over again. You know what I mean? The science is changing, obviously, but I think there's probably a lot of books like this that are every 10 years or so, that are great. Or the other thing is more than that, because like every publisher will have their version of it.
Right.
Will have their version of it, it's obviously way, way more. Even if you limit it to just like science and skepticism, there's way more books out there than you could possibly read. And it's fun sometimes. Sometimes I've read books that are like 30, 40 years old, like science books, just to see like what they were talking
about. Yeah, they're kind of funny.
Then. It's kind of fun. I'm always surprised at how the same they are and how different they are. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Well, a concept of falsifiability and falsification is important and definitely is true throughout the history of understanding science.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of a core concept there, I guess.
It's an important concept.
Theories have to make predictions, and they stand the test of time when they resist concerted efforts to falsify them. That's it.
Separates it from pseudoscience.
Yes, one of the main things, absolutely. All right, guys, thank you all for joining me this week.
You got it, brother.
Thank you,
Steve.
We'll see you on the Friday live stream. Again, if you don't know, Friday, 5 o'clock Eastern time, we get together, some of us. We'll get together for a live streaming thing about an hour and a half we go. We occasionally have guests. It's a lot of fun. It's very unscripted. We often will play a game. We take questions. Mm-hmm. So join us if you can. Jay, how do you get to that?
Just go to the skepticsguide.org homepage for the link.
Great. And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information, visit us at theskepticsguide.org. Send your questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. And if you would like to support the show and all the work that we do, go to patreon.com/skepticsguide and consider becoming a patron and becoming part of the SGU community. Our listeners and supporters are what make SGU possible.